Hello everyone, and a warm welcome back to the Finals Countdown series, which is brought to you by MedTalks. In this series of podcast episodes, we are providing all of you medical students, in other words, the future of our NHS, with short, succinct, and super useful revision talks for your knowledge and for any upcoming exams. We're still in the gastroenterology section, making our way through the GI tract, and in today's talk, I'll be going through a very common gastroenterology condition. It's a part of inflammatory bowel disease, and it's called ulcerative colitis. Before I get into the meat of this episode, I'd just like to take a moment to mention the sponsors of this episode, and they are Wesleyan. Right, so Wesleyan is a company that was set up way back in 1841, and they provide tailored financial advice and products to multiple professional groups, including doctors, dentists, and teachers. And I'd like to just touch on Wesleyan's latest project called The Next Step. So The Next Step is born from the Wesleyan tradition of giving back. Built in collaboration with final year students, The Next Step brings together some of the brightest sparks in medicine for live events, workshops, exam resources, content, and podcasts to make the step into F1 a little easier. They address subject matter you didn't know you needed to know. So go on and follow them on Instagram by searching at the Wes Next Step, or Facebook by searching at The Next Step, -Wesleyan, or go and visit their website, which is thenextstep.wesleyan.co.uk. All right, let's get back to the episode. So, ulcerative colitis is a chronic condition of the gastrointestinal system, which involves inflammation of the colon. It is one of two conditions that encompasses inflammatory bowel disease, the other one being Crohn's disease, which we talked about in the previous episode. So we will go on to discuss the differences and the similarities between the two conditions. Now, ulcerative colitis is the most common form of inflammatory bowel disease, with an increasing prevalence across the world. Estimates are 5 to 500 per 100,000 worldwide. And the peak incidence rates are in late adolescence and early adulthood, so between 20 and 40 years old. And there is a second small peak in the 50s. In terms of male to female ratio, well, this is fairly equal. So why does it occur? Now, the actual etiology behind ulcerative colitis, or UC, is not entirely known. It is thought that bacteria within the colon trigger an autoimmune inflammatory process, which then leads to the inflammation within the GI tract. And like many autoimmune diseases, there is a mixture of genetic and environmental factors that contribute to this disease. So environmental factors include smoking, where, strangely enough, the risk of developing UC is lower in smokers. And this is contrast to Crohn's disease, where the risk is higher in smokers. Family history also plays a big role, with the risk of UC greatest in first degree relatives, but also raised in second and third degree. Okay, so how does UC present? Now, the cardinal feature is bloody diarrhea, which may also be mixed with mucus. So, as soon as a young patient presents with bloody diarrhea, you need to rule out any inflammatory bowel disease, particularly UC. Now, other symptoms that may feature include abdominal pain, which comes and goes, or is better described as colicky, a sense of urgency, and high frequency of bowel movements. Patients may experience tenesmus, and this is the feeling of incomplete emptying of the bowels, but it's often misinterpreted as constipation. Patients may also experience constipation and rectal bleeding if the UC is limited to the rectum, which is also known as proctitis. And there may be some systemic symptoms such as fever, malaise, and weight loss. UC patients may also present with extraintestinal features, and this is about 4% of patients, most commonly affecting the joints, the eyes, and the skin. So firstly, we'll start with the joints. Patients may have a seronegative arthritis, where it can affect a few large joints, so oligoarthritis, the vertebrae, ankylosing spondylitis, or small hand joints, so peripheral arthritis. They may have sacroiliitis, which is inflammation of the sacroiliac joint. Secondly, the eyes. So patients may have anterior uveitis and present with blurry vision, eye pain, photophobia, and if left untreated, it can lead to visual loss. Also, episcleritis or scleritis. This is inflammation of the white part of the eye called the sclera and the overlying connective tissue, also known as the episclera. In terms of the skin, patients may develop aphthous ulcers within the mouth, erythema nodosum, which are raised tender erythematous nodules on the shins, and this is inflammation of the underlying subcutaneous tissue, and also pyoderma gangrenosum, which are painful pustules or nodules that turn into ulcers. Now, anemia is a common feature in patients with UC, and this is secondary to inflammation. So the immune system attacks the red blood cells as well, and also secondary to chronic bleeding from the GI tract, which worsens the patient's fatigue. Ulcerative colitis is associated with primary sclerosing cholangitis, which is an inflammatory disorder of the bile ducts. This episode will be available soon. Now, what features might you see with a patient on UC on examination? Depending on the disease severity, patients may present with tachycardia, hypotension if they are unwell. They may look pale due to the anemia, and they may be febrile due to the inflammation. Patients may appear with dehydration, and this is if the losses exceed their oral intake, and this may also worsen the tachycardia and hypotension if it's severe. On examination of the abdomen, there may be tenderness, localized or general, and abdominal distension. If patients have abdominal distension and tenderness, then they need admission and an urgent abdominal x-ray to rule out a toxic megacolon, which can be fatal. And I will talk more about this shortly. Similarly, if they are exhibiting signs of severe dehydration, then they will need admission for fluid resuscitation. Okay, so as always, it's important to think about differential diagnoses. So what else could it be if it's not UC? So the number one differential would be Crohn's disease, as the clinical features are very similar. Diarrhea due to excessive or prolonged use of laxatives. Infective colitis, so this is where you get inflammation of the colon, which is triggered by some kind of infection. Irritable bowel syndrome, or IBS. Ischemic colitis, radiation colitis, diverticulitis, and polyps. Right, so how are we going to diagnose ulcerative colitis? Well, the first step would be clinical findings, as we've already discussed. And then we need to do some more definitive investigations. So let's start with some blood tests. So a full blood count will show anemia. Renal function may show dehydration, so a raised urea and creatinine, possibly a low potassium, so hypokalemia due to the diarrhea. We need to check the other things like LFTs. CRP will be elevated because this is an inflammatory process. Magnesium is likely to be low because of the diarrhea. We need to do some serum LFTs, including albumin, and a low serum albumin may indicate a protein-losing enteropathy, and this can reflect disease activity and severity in addition to nutritional status. We should check thyroid function tests to exclude hyperthyroidism, which can cause diarrhea. And we need to check serum ferritin, B12, folate, and vitamin D levels because there may be nutritional deficiencies as a result of malabsorption or intestinal losses. And we also should check the serological markers. So P. ANCA is associated with ulcerative colitis. Stool studies, so we need to check fecal calprotectin. So the body releases this biomarker when there is an inflammatory process ongoing within the intestines, and higher levels are associated with inflammatory bowel disease. We also need to send a stool sample for microscopy and culture to ensure there is no C. diff colitis or other infectious organisms in the stool, which may explain the symptoms. So those are the blood tests and the stool samples. Now we move on to imaging and procedures. So sigmoidoscopy and a rectal biopsy should be done for all patients presenting with diarrhea that's suspicious for inflammatory bowel disease, an abdominal x-ray to rule out a toxic megacolon, and other imaging which may be helpful but not necessarily diagnostic is an ultrasound of the abdomen or a CT scan. But typically, first line for diagnosing colitis is a colonoscopy and a biopsy. So colonoscopy is preferable to a flexible sigmoidoscopy because the extent of disease can be assessed. However, in moderate to severe disease, there is a higher chance of bowel perforation with a colonoscopy, so a flexible sigmoidoscopy is safer. Now, the severity of ulcerative colitis is classified using the TrueLove and WITS Severity Index for adults, and this is what's used in the NICE guidelines. So there's mild, moderate, and severe. So mild ulcerative colitis is the following: less than 4 stools a day, only a small amount of blood in the stools, no anemia, a heart rate of 90 beats per minute or less, apyrexial, and a normal ESR and CRP. Moderate UC is between 4 and 6 stools a day. More blood in the stools than mild. No anemia. A heart rate of 90 or less. Apyrexial and a normal ESR and CRP. And severe UC is 6 or more stools per day. Visible blood in the stools and at least one of a temperature above 37.8 degrees Celsius, a heart rate above 90 beats per minute, anemia, and an ESR above 30. So, when should we admit a patient to hospital? Well, if they've got severe colitis, according to the True Love and Wits Index, if they have moderate disease, which fails to respond to steroids within 2 weeks, and if they have a partial response to treatment and they need an urgent outpatient appointment. So, how do we manage ulcerative colitis? At this point, I'd like to bring in the NICE guidelines. But the management can depend on the location of the disease and its severity. So we'll start with acute severe colitis, and this is for all extents of disease. Now, this may be a first presentation of the condition or an inflammatory exacerbation. And the following treatment steps are laid out in the NICE guidelines. So step one, patients should be started on IV steroids to induce remission, and this is typically IV hydrocortisone. If patients can't take steroids or they decline steroids or steroids are contraindicated, then IV cyclosporine or surgery would be the next steps. Okay, so that's step one. For step two, if steroids had not made significant improvement within 72 hours of starting them, or the symptoms worsen during this time, then IV cyclosporine or surgery should be considered. And if cyclosporine is contraindicated or not clinically appropriate, then infliximab can be used. Now do bear in mind that this should all be under specialist advice. So if a patient is not already on the gastroenterology ward, an early referral to the gastroenterology team should be done as soon as the patient is admitted. Okay, which patients should be strongly considered for surgery early doors? Well, those who are producing stool frequency more than 8 per day, those who are pyrexial, tachycardic, those who have an abdominal x-ray which shows colonic dilatation, or patients with a low albumin, low hemoglobin, high platelet count, or a CRP above 45. But again, advice from the gastroenterology team should be sought early on. Okay, so now I'll move on to talk about induction of remission and maintenance of remission for the different locations of the disease and the different severities. So for proctitis, in other words, disease that's confined to the rectum, the following step-by-step management is applied for the induction of remission. So the first line is topical aminosalicylates. So this is first line for mild to moderate presentation or for an inflammatory exacerbation. And the most common example of an aminosalicylate is 5-ASA or 5-aminosalicylic acid, which is also known as mesalazine. If topical is declined, then we can offer oral, but patients should be made aware that it's not as effective. And if patients can't tolerate aminosalicylates, then we should consider using steroids in a time-limited course, which is typically 4 to 8 weeks. Second line would be consider adding an oral aminosalicylate if no remission is achieved in 4 weeks. And third line would be to consider adding a topical or an oral steroid if further treatment is required. So for proctosigmoiditis and left-sided ulcerative colitis, so that's the rectum, sigmoid colon, and the left side of the descending colon, mild to moderate, the first line is topical aminosalicylate. If no remission is achieved in 4 weeks, then we should add a high-dose oral aminosalicylate or switch to a high-dose amino and a time-limited course of topical steroid. Third line, if further treatment is required, we should stop the topical treatment and offer an oral aminosalicylate and an oral steroid. And if topical treatment is declined, then we should consider a high dose aminosalicylate alone. But again, we need to warn patients that it's not as effective as topical. For extensive disease, if we want to induce remission, we need to give, first line is a topical aminosalicylate and a high dose oral aminosalicylate. Second line, if remission is not achieved in 4 weeks, we stop the topical and we give a combination of high-dose oral aminosalicylate and a time-limited course of oral steroids. So that's for inducing remission. Now, in terms of maintaining remission,
so it's quite similar. It involves use of topical aminosalicylates or oral aminosalicylates plus topical or oral plus steroid. And I think I advise you to check out the NICE guidelines for more information on those. The difference with maintaining remission for all extensive disease is that often oral azathioprine or mercaptopurine are considered to maintain remission for those who have had two or more inflammatory exacerbations in 12 months that have required systemic corticosteroids. And I advise you to check out the NICE guidelines for further details on this. If there's no response to medical treatment or patients are intolerant to it, then we need to consider surgery, and this would be a colectomy. So this is curative, as ulcerative colitis is confined to the colorectal regions. So the usual procedure is a restorative proctocolectomy with an ileopouch anal anastomosis. So this is removal of the colon and the rectum. The end of the small intestine, the ileum, is used as an internal pouch, which is shaped like a J, and it's connected to the top of the anal canal. Patients have to have a stoma initially to allow the pouch to heal, and then a couple of months later, this ileostomy is reversed, and the small intestine will be reconnected. The pouch will then collect waste and allow stool to pass through the anus in a normal bowel movement. Okay, so what are the complications of ulcerative colitis? Well, firstly, there is an increased risk of colorectal cancer in patients with inflammatory bowel disease. The main risk to be aware of is toxic megacolon, and we did touch briefly on this earlier, but I'll go through it in more detail now. So, this is a potentially life-threatening complication of an inflammatory or an infective colitis. Infective colitis such as C. diff infection. There is segmental non-obstructive dilatation of the colon, where it's more than 6 centimeters in diameter, and there is systemic toxicity, so fever, abdominal pain, possibly shock. So the signs and symptoms you might see are abdominal pain, bloating, tenderness, tachycardia, dehydration. There may be signs of septic shock, a lack of bowel movements, and there's significant colonic dilatation seen on abdominal x-ray. How do we manage it? Well, we need to decompress the bowel, prevent any swallowed air from further distending the bowel, and if decompression is not achieved or the patient doesn't improve, then they will need a colectomy, so surgical removal of the colon. We need to give them fluid and electrolyte replacement to treat any shock and dehydration, and steroids may be required to suppress any inflammatory reaction if it's due to active inflammatory bowel disease, and also antibiotics to prevent sepsis. Right, so this is now drawing towards the end of the episode, and as I mentioned at the beginning, ulcerative colitis is one of two parts of the umbrella condition inflammatory bowel disease, and I'd said that I'd briefly touch on the similarities and the differences between ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease, because this is the sort of stuff that will be tested in your exams. And of course, important knowledge for you to know when you're actually seeing patients in person. So the similarities between the two are that they are both autoimmune inflammatory conditions. So this is where our body's immune system starts to attack part of the GI tract and cause symptoms such as abdominal pain, diarrhea, feeling of tenesmus. But there are key differences between the two. The first is a site of origin. So for ulcerative colitis, the site of origin is the rectum, whereas for Crohn's disease, the site of origin is the terminal ileum. The cardinal feature for Crohn's disease is crampy abdominal pain, whereas for ulcerative colitis, it's bloody diarrhea. And then we'll look at the actual pathological process. So Crohn's disease is a transmural pathology, so it affects the entire wall of the colon, whereas ulcerative colitis, it affects the mucosa and the submucosa. Crohn's disease can be found anywhere along the colon, along the GI tract, so from the mouth to the anus. And the way I remember it is I say that Crohn's owns the GI tract, whereas ulcerative colitis is usually confined to one area, that typically being the rectum. And ulcerative colitis has a continuous distribution in the area that it's causing the disease, whereas with Crohn's, there is a discontinuous distribution, and we often find skip lesions where there is no pathological process. In terms of complications, ulcerative colitis can lead to hemorrhage within the GI tract. It can lead to toxic megacolon, whereas Crohn's disease can cause fistulas, abscesses, and bowel obstruction. In terms of treatment, well, pharmacological treatment can be similar, so use of mesalazine or aminosalicylates, use of steroids as well. But in terms of surgery, typically surgery is curative for ulcerative colitis, whereas it's normally used to treat complications of Crohn's such as strictures. Ulcerative colitis has a much greater risk associated with colon cancer compared to Crohn's. And also, just to reiterate what I briefly touched on earlier, was that smokers have a reduced risk of ulcerative colitis, whereas they have an increased risk of Crohn's disease. Okay, so I think we'll bring this episode to a close now. Today we've talked about ulcerative colitis, one of the two parts of inflammatory bowel diseases, and we spoke about Crohn's disease in the previous episode, so you can go and check that out on all podcast platforms. We've talked all about what causes ulcerative colitis, how patients might present, how we diagnose it, and then how we manage it, and looked at the complications and the similarities and the differences between Crohn's and ulcerative colitis. As always, I hope you found this episode useful. Please remember to share them with your friends and your peers who may also find them useful. Give us your feedback. Let us know what you think of them. Let us know how we can improve. And subscribe to our channels for plenty more episodes coming up. And as always, thank you very much for listening, and we will see you in the next one. If you guys do have any questions you want to ask us, then please feel free to message us on our social media platforms. You can search MedTalks on Instagram and Facebook and just drop us a message. Or alternatively, you can email us, and our email address is hellomedtalks@gmail.com. We look forward to hearing from you. Take care, all the best, and goodbye.